So again, as you were saying, David wanted to be here, but David couldn't make it, right? So
I'm going to have to ask you to intentionally speak up.
I will.
And remember it, because it takes effort to speak louder.
I will.
You know, I want you to speak continuously loud.
Which he, by the way, just, you know, don't, so you don't feel bad about it.
I'm bad at it.
I have this fight with him all the time, and he says, I don't know, speak louder. So, motherfucker, speak louder. So just so you don't feel like this is a common Zach.
It's true.
He thinks it's sexy.
Yeah,
it's true. Well, I draw people in.
Right, right. It's a manipulative move. Listen.
Okay, so I'll make that effort. I'll make the effort.
Okay.
What I was saying was that David J. Teble wanted to be here. He wanted to come, but he couldn't make it.
Yeah.
So we're talking here at your place. We want to speak about wholeness and value.
Sure.
So I think Mark wanted to kick it off a little bit.
Yeah, maybe we'll kick it off. But just to say that we're here to celebrate the release of First Principles and First Values,
right,
which is really exciting. And just to say that to our friend John Mackey, who's listening, right, John stepped in and created this possibility for Ken and I to work on this, Zach, many years ago.
Right.
And this is a fulfillment of a commitment to John to kind of put out, you know, a book together. And John was super excited, obviously excited that
right.
Zach has stepped in. And so David J. Teble has come through big time. And thank you, John. So that's a good place to start.
Right.
And David also did say one thing, Ken. He said something. He said he really liked the wig. He said he liked the wig. Yeah, he did say that.
Great.
So I wanted just to share that. Okay. So now we got that stuff out of the way.
Good.
Fuck. So we're here to talk about, as Zach said, and it's just so delightful to be at the beginning of another set of conversations.
Right.
And by the way, this is the last, by the way, this is, people are not aware of this. Ken and I did a series of conversations in, I don't know, 6-7 years ago on Eros and sexuality, on the 7 levels of sexuality. So that's now a 12-volume set, which has been completed. So these things get somewhere, right? So it's very exciting. So this is kind of David.
What are you doing with it?
It's going to be published by World Philosophy and Religion Press, first as a two motherfucker volumes, kind of big, you know, and then 12 individual volumes. And it's the phenomenology of Eros. It's really about Eros. Zach subjected it to a very critical reading, you know, on multiple levels. So it's gone through, you know, many years of revision and care. But it's done, and it's monumental. And you are clearly present, evoked, and of course, cited.
Ah.
Right? So yay. Yay.
Great.
Yay. It's fantastic. So David really wants us to talk about how do you know what you know? Anthroontology. And by anthroontology that Ken and Zach and I have talked about before, you know, we mean anthro-human being. And I'm just starting from the beginning, anthro-human being, ontology, for real, for realsies is the Latin word. So that which is for real, true existence, the true essence, nature of things, that I know by accessing my own interiors, or anthroontology in some sense, there is a mystery and the mystery is within us. Something like that. Now, what we want to particularly look at is this mystery through the prism of two lenses, one that David J. Teble spent a lot of time in this book, First Principles and First Values, and one that Ken spent a lot of time about completely independently in this new book about to be released about wholeness. And I would just note that, Ken, you've been in this wholeness conversation for a long time. You know, back in 2004, you recommended, when I was talking about four faces of Eros, that the fourth face, which was then the interconnectivity of the all with the all, you said, no, that should be wholeness, which I changed and returned to Eros, and that was yours. So this is an ongoing conversation for many, many years, so it's really exciting to get to this place. And let me see if I can just like we've always done, I'll just lay down a few tracks and pass to Zach, and then Ken will take it open right into his world and we'll play. So let's begin. So first off, what we're saying is that mystery within us could be called wholeness, it could be called value, And those are somehow two faces of the one. And perhaps one of the things we want to explore today is the relationship between them. Are they related? Are they the same word? Are they different words? So that's one. Two, let me kind of look at it from the perspective of
I'm quite uncomfortable on the couch. I'm just going to move it between us. I'm just going to go like that.
Great.
It's like, then I'll move back to you.
That's right. So let me enter for a second from the perspective of value. So we've established, David's established a formula, which is clarified desire equals value. So it's based on a bunch of premises in cosmorotic humanism. And Ken, you've written way before cosmorotic humanism. I was writing an Eros on my side. You invoked Eros in multiple texts all through the years. And we've talked about Eros really from the beginning.
Right. And Eros for me is a primary force
right
in the whole cosmos.
Right. And when we speak of Eros, and we formulated an interior science equation of Eros, and by Eros we mean the experience that moves through all of reality, all the way up and all the way down, of radical aliveness, desiring ever deeper contact and ever greater wholeness. So that's an interior science equation of Eros that appears, of course, in First Principles and First Values that we've tested over the last 10 years. And you can talk about Eros in an organization, Eros between people, Eros, on the biochemical level, right? And Eros in the pure world of interiors, and we're talking about the same thing, Eros. So reality is Eros. One of the faces of Eros, the qualities of Eros, is desire. Desire moves towards deeper contact and greater wholeness. So clarified desire yields value. Now, and here I'm going to say a couple more things and pass to you, Zach, just to set up. We could rewrite the Eros equation in one of two ways. We could say Eros equals radical aliveness, desiring ever deeper contact and ever greater wholeness. Or we could say the exact same thing. Eros equals radical aliveness, desiring moving towards ever deeper contact and ever greater value. The equation actually works both ways. Right? And it's one of the places you begin to see the kind of, inter-inclusion of desire, of value and wholeness. So that we actually have this understanding that value is not just like, Ken, you immediately said, Eros is cosmic Eros. We're understanding it the same way we always have. So by value, we don't mean values. We don't mean Christian values or the values conversation. By value, we mean the field of value in which all values are included, right? And that is in the interior science tradition of Solomon, the lineage of Solomon, which strangely was pointed out to me when I was talking about it as mirrored by Whitehead, and I looked it up, it's true, in Process and Reality. One of the 10 sephirot, the 10 luminations, is Tiferet. Tiferet means beauty. Beauty is the intensification of experience in which nothing is left out and all opposites are included. So the other name for Tiferet, beauty, is shalom, wholeness. Because shalom, the word shalom, literally means wholeness, of course. So it's very beautiful. So we have this sense of a field of value or a field of wholeness in which we participate, which discloses, and here's the last sentence, which discloses not an answer, but at least a response to three questions. Where am I? Who am I? And what ought I do? What ought I do? Ought. Ought, as in the ought. Not just an is, but an ought.
Should.
Right, should, right, should. That's right, should, should. So in other words, now, it's entering into this field of value or field of wholeness discloses some direction. It doesn't answer. It's not a fundamentalist answer, but it's a response that orients, where am I? Who am I? And what ought I do? And that's significant, and maybe this is the last sentence, that's significant, then we've teed it up. Because not by accident, when Turing writes his great essay, Morphogenesis, and he's trying to figure out how you create coherent complexity. So we could summarize all the mathematics and cut through all of Morphogenesis. He basically says simple first rules are iterated again and again and again and again, and they generate coherent complexity.
Yeah, and that force is Eros.
And that is Eros. That is Eros itself, right? It's Eros all the way up and all the way down.
Right.
And so if we would say, okay, what are the simple first rules that are the scripts of desire, the scripts of Eros, it would be the answer to the simplest three questions. And the simplest three questions are, who am I? Where am I? Or in the Bible, where the fuck am I? Right? And what should I do? So this is just, we've begun anthropology.
Is there a why?
Interestingly, that's very, very interesting, right? I was talking to a great guy who's actually a great sports guy, very smart. And we were talking about this a few months ago, and he said, where's the why, right? And we deliberately left out the why because the why is where people usually go, of course. But when they go there, they get lost in theology or theologic. Theology, theologic. They try and work out the why. But there's actually a sense that if you actually have a sense of where you are, I'm in a field of Eros, you know, who you are, you're a unique incarnation of Eros. What should I do? I should uniquely incarnate Eros in the world. Then the why question kind of falls away. And what people tend to do is move towards the why, but bypass, right, those three more elemental questions. So we thought that actually
they're more elemental, but does why really disappear?
So I don't say it disappears. I get it. It's a great inquiry. I think it's not disappears. It is self-evidently responded to. So I'll give you an example, and I don't know if this is an experience that's familiar to you, and maybe we shouldn't talk about that now, but there's an experience in reality which is called orgasm. So it's described in many texts. So when a person is like a moment before, right, the height of the most cataclysmic orgasm with the right person at the right time, in the most ethical mutual situation, they don't stop and say, why do I exist? Very few people, and people who do that are in need of some therapy, right?
Or they might ask other why questions, like why am I making love to this particular person?
Right.
So
those why questions hopefully are earlier, right? Because once you're at the moment before explosion, it's a little late. So there's a moment where you're so in Eros, or you're so in, you know, there's a beautiful person who's in the think tank today, who's a great linguist, who she wrote her doctorate, you know, in Leningrad in one particular language, and she's painted a painting for each of Shakespeare's sonnets that are stunning. She's like a true intellectual, you know, Russian artist. Right. And when she goes into painting, she's like gone. She's like the full Eros of reality moving through her, and the why falls away. Then when she comes out of painting, she comes back to the why. So there's a moment in which, I mean, I'll give you a more simple moment, and I'll pass to you, pass to Zach. Okay,
she comes back to the why.
She comes back to the why.
Okay, but then it wasn't excluded.
It doesn't exclude it, but then she remembers there's a moment in which it falls away. I'll give you the last example. When we said hello yesterday, I was so happy to see you that really the why of even our trip didn't matter. It was just, it falls away. It's like, huh, right? So there's a moment in which the why disappears, and then it appropriately reappears, but then we're infused by a response to where and to who and to what, which allows us to reapproach the why, not as sophistry,
right,
but as something real.
Well, that tells me, that gives me another reason to include why.
Huh.
Because it brings together all these other important questions.
Huh.
So is there any reason we can't have four fundamental questions?
No. Let's. So let's think about, right? Let's include. Let's tentatively include why, but in this, and we'll go to Zach. But what you're saying is, I'll make sure I get it straight. We're not including why in a kind of, in a surface way. We're including why in its ultimate depth.
Yeah, because so many people go to why first, just as you said, even though they misunderstand it.
Right.
Well, we'll give a correct interpretation of the why. And the why is basically the operation of all the other three.
Right. It's exactly, by the way, that sentence is critical. The why is the operation of all the other three. So to get to the why on the other side.
That's another reason to include it.
But
specify that the why is resolved performatively, like the why is resolved through practice. So I remember, Ken, at some point in Sex, Ecology, Spirituality, you say something like, the mind-body dualism cannot be resolved by me talking to you about it. It can only be resolved in something like Kensho, right? Which, for the time you're in it, there is no sense of mind and body being separate at all. And then you come out of it, and you're like, oh, now I'm neurotically separate from my body. So I think similarly with the why, the moving through these questions allows for the why to be answered in practice.
Right.
Rather than the why to be answered as a bunch of sentences that go through your head that you try to fit into the world, you're answering it spontaneously through practice. So the performativity of the why, of the response to the why, different from the other ones. So that's one way.
Go ahead.
So that's one way in. And then... So I don't want to move us off of this because I have other things to say.
Let's stay with the why for a second. If we stay with the why and then come, is that okay?
Yeah, please.
Why is
big? Two questions.
This is why. Just let's first get the why and then turn it to you, holy man. But it's actually, it's just, I forgot about something. Wow. So there's a tradition in the lineage, and I'm now remembering, Ken, that you and I actually talked about it maybe a decade ago, or maybe it was in our conversation on evil. Maybe we talk about it then. But so we have, let's say, 10 sephirot, 10 luminations, 10 in the tree of life. Let's just use that image.
Right.
So whenever you do a normative action in the world, you're identified with one of the bottom seven. If I help an old lady across the street, I'm in number 5. If I write each action, normative action, identifies me with one of the bottom seven. When I scream out, why? Luria writes, I'm identified only then with the highest of the three.
Well, that's especially important.
Right? So that why is a why, though, that is after I have an experience of the where, the who, and the what. So I'll just give an example. When Ivan is talking to Alyosha in Brothers Karamazov after that horrible scene where the general, right, has the boy ripped apart by the dogs, and Ivan says, right, is I want nothing to do with your God. I don't want to be there when the general and the boy make up with Jesus. Like, fuck this, right? And Alyosha doesn't understand it. He's screaming this why, but he has no place to go with it because... there's no conversation. There's no reality that's meaningful. There's no eros. So that why question then leads, for example, the gentleman from Caltech who wrote a book called War of Worldviews with a colleague of ours, you know, he says he rejects all spiritual arguments because he says, you know, my grandmother was, was made to kneel in Auschwitz and the commandment walked behind her and randomly killed this person, didn't kill that person, killed that person. He says, that why is so big, I reject all of spirit. And that why is beautiful. It's holy heresy. It's the heresy that's holy. But we need, in order to really ask the why and not have the why destroy me, right? I have to actually ground so deeply, as you were saying, Zach, citing the Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality material, I've got to ground my gnosis in such deep practice that the why doesn't destroy me. So there's these two kinds of why.
Yeah.
The why that's destructive and the why that creates. That is the ultimate question of spirit.
Yeah. And I would say to touch on value and wholeness, the why that creates would be a why that seeks more wholeness, bigger answers to why. There's a way of answering why, which is why it's a dangerous question, is that you can answer why and give it a very concrete idolatrous answer, right? Like, why do I exist? Fill in the blank. The point is, if you can fill in the blank, you're fucked, right? Yeah. That the thing needs to be infinity. It needs to be a deep, deep answer. And so I do, like an infinity. The answer to why needs to be some type of infinity. It needs to be an impossible ideal. It needs to be something like the Bodhisattva vow, which emerges out of a deepening into the field of value. Whereas a neurotic, pathological, nihilistic answer, you could say, oh, why? I'm here to become the most famous technologist who's ever existed and implant my, you know, technologies and shape all the future of history, right? That would be a very narrow, idolatrous answer, not seeking wholeness. Whereas sincere seeking of wholeness through the asking of why, sincere seeking of wholeness through the answer in that question, in the why, is one of the deepest inquiries you can ask sincerely. Like, similar to who am I would be something like why at that highest.
You know, at that highest.
At that highest.
So really what we're saying is that let's reframe the three great questions of cosmorotic humanism as four great questions of cosmorotic humanism. Let's bring the why, right? Now, we think, Zach, we excluded the why because we didn't want to go for the narrow why.
Sure.
But when we go for the big why, right?
It's necessary.
It's absolutely necessary. It actually reminds me of the conversations we had many years ago around certainty and uncertainty, right? So what Zach is suggesting is, what we're both saying is that, and what Ken was implying, we all realize there's a why that can be answered with a false certainty. So we have to avoid false certainties, and it's almost like we have to instantiate in our interiors Gödel's incompleteness theorem, you know, as applied to meaning, right? Meaning there are no complete mathematical sets, right? It goes on into infinity. Right? There's this why that's never going to be ultimately answered, and yet can be approached. And that question also disappears at moments of radical lived certainty. We greet each other after having not seen each other for a number of years. We're ecstatic. At that moment, the why question disappears. It's self-evident goodness. But then it comes back. But then we're informed by, we would say, by that value or by that wholeness. So a why question uninformed by value or uninformed by wholeness is devastating.
Yeah. And let's remember that a la Whitehead, a whole is actually a whole arm. It's a whole part. And as far as I can tell, there are almost no exceptions to that, with the possible exception of infinity or Godhead or ground. But Eros is what moves from one holon to another holon. And a holon, of course, is a whole that's part of a larger whole. And so everything in the universe is created of holons. And they all unfold. So we have evolution operating at all levels in all areas. And we have to be careful to distinguish value from whole, from holons in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because not all values are made of lesser values, which are made of lesser values and
That's
so
right.
on.
That's correct.
But wholeness is, I mean, to the extent that we have an existing value, that value is going to be a whole lot.
Right.
So I actually started thinking about all the stuff that I had read in the theory of value,
mm-hmm.
The philosophy of the theory of value. And I just made a couple notes on
Fantastic.
What scholars distinguish types of value. And I have three, four, five major types. I'll just mention them.
Let's play.
Briefly.
Let's play.
So we can, and I'm not sure any of these are necessary as a component part of our discussion. I mean, we can always, they're always footnotes.
Right.
But for example, we have intrinsic value and instrumental value.
Right.
So instrumental value is something that helps you get to something that's really intrinsically valuable.
Right.
And intrinsic value is something that has value in and of itself. So that's a fairly straightforward
That's one.
We have Immanuel Kant, who distinguished between hypothetical and categorical value. And a categorical value is an absolute value, and a hypothetical value is a relative value. So an absolute value or categorical value is act according to those maxims you would see as a universal law.
Right, categorical imperative.
Categorical imperative, that's right. And, of course, Kant tried to find mostly just those values which are categorical.
Right.
But he recognized that there were hypothetical values, and they were usually involved in if-then statements. So the sun is valuable only if you don't live in a desert, because then you can be overcome by it, and then it becomes a bad, not a good.
Right.
But just any if Sally dances with John, that's good.
Right.
So
right.
Good.
Right.
But that's not something that we would want to make a universal.
No, it is not.
In economic theory, they have donor-type value and receiver-type value. And receiver-type value is the value, well, it's in the market, it's your willingness to pay for something.
Right.
And so that can vary enormously from 5 cents to $5 million mm-hmm. or so on. And a donor-type value is what actually had to go in. The labor or the value or the creativity or the substance, the structure that had to go into creating the product.
Right.
Not what somebody's willing to pay for it.
Right.
Which is a receiver. And then other theories of value divide between an end value and an aims value.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just exactly what they mean.
Right.
Something that has value as an end, or
right.
something that is a way to get
right.
to that end value. And then they have something that gets often mentioned, and I've never quite gotten it, but a good first theory of value and what's called a value first theory. And a good first theory, these are known as the different topics for value claims. One puts good first and one puts value first. And there is making a distinction between the good and the valuable. So pleasure is good, is a good first type of
mm-hmm.
value. It's just pleasure is in itself is good. And a value first is claims that pleasure is a value, and that the more value you have, the better something is.
Right.
So they go back and
right.
forth between these two ways to talk about. Like I say, I'm not sure. I think that when we look at how we're talking about value, we can determine what these are talking about. But I don't think it's necessary to any of these, which I find is weird because it sort of tosses out the whole theory of value from philosophy.
It's quite pallid. I mean, there's something we could say here, though, in one limited regard, which might be helpful, which is there's two parts to value theory, right? I mean, there's a lot to say about value theory, obviously, right, in terms of multiple formulations and also the relationship between deontological value and teleological value,
right?
So there's which is important we can get to, but let me step back for a second. In general, there's value which is related to economics, right? I value something economically. Right. And then there's value, which is an instrumental, and all those kinds are kind of related to that economic line. And then there's this other kind of value, which is intrinsic, and we would call it in some sense priceless. It's non-commodifiable,
right?
And it's the realm of the priceless. It's not in any way. It's its own end, right? Of itself, it's intrinsic, etc. However, there's a relationship between those two kinds of value. Those two strains have a relationship, much like we talked about years back, and there's a chapter on it. There's a relationship between separate self and unique self. The difference is in between them is true self, right? But separate self is isolated, fragmented. It's not true. It's an illusion. It's not who you are. And yet it's pointing to something. Right? In other words, separate self is not a mistake in the field of value. Reality generated this experience of separateness, and separateness exists in the mind of God. So, but separate self points towards something which is unique self, which is this unique individuation, right, of the ultimate true self field that you always liked to add the sentence, the singular that has no plural, right?
Yeah.
Which is beautiful.
Yeah, and I also wrote a book called The Atman Project, which talks about the relation between those
two.
Now, the small self is always intuiting.
It's always pointing towards, right? And in unique self, we talk about these 30 distinctions between ego and unique self, and that each one of those, the ego is pointing towards unique self. So in a similar way...
And often confuses itself.
And often confuses itself. I talk about the pointing... Right, a lot in unique self. You talk about the confusion in Atman Project, when it hijacks, for example, I believe you talk about there, it hijacks immortality, for example, as its own.
The immortality project,
which is a form of what I call someplace else. We talk about pseudo-eros. But to stay on this, the two lines of value are not completely unrelated. Right? They're actually, there's a reason they're both called value, and this is one of the places that Wittgenstein wasn't wrong, right? There's a field of language here. So in some sense, I have a desire, and when I desire, value. Now, the more deeply I clarify my desire, the more I get to my deepest heart's desire, the more I get to the intrinsic desire of the ontic infinite that's awake and alive in me, the more that will point me towards intrinsic desire, and the more I'm locked in my surface desires, I can't clarify my desires, or I'm locked in my trauma, right? And I can't disambiguate myself from my trauma, or whatever the set of issues is that we all experience, right? Then actually my desire points me towards instrumental value, right? Or, right, I simply have a healthy separate self, right, that points me towards instrumental value, right, which itself has value.
Sure.
Right? And instrumental value itself has value as part of life and the affirmation of life, which participates in an eternal value. So there's not a sharp dichotomy between them. And one of the things that value theory does is it too sharply dichotomizes between them, when actually one points towards the other. But as you said, an Atman Project, we could apply it here, right? The instrumental value could confuse itself with absolute value. So it feels that it's valuable, then it confuses itself and it hijacks the identity of absolute value.
Right, exactly. And a classic distinction between exchange value and use value in Marxism, very similar to your receiver versus creator value. And one of the things that has to happen at planetary scale is the alignment of use value with exchange value, which means something like, how much is a tree actually worth, right? Because right now we sell it for a few hundred dollars of lumber, but it actually holds the soil together and makes houses for birds that we need and emits oxygen. And
it has an ecological value.
It has an ecological value that's probably in like the millions or billions of dollars, like one tree. Like we couldn't make it. And so we're profoundly confused about how valuable is the tree? Is it invaluable or is it sellable for $300? And so you just like multiply that to all of the, that's happening everywhere on the planet, fundamental misevaluation of things like nature. And it's a confusion of exchange value for use value. In the short term, cut the trees down, make the money, build your house. In the long term, we're realizing that we're fucked. It's a very fundamental misunderstanding of how valuable nature is. And so part of the project here with value theory, with cosmoradic humanism, is reinvigorating the languages of value that stand against the simplistic economic reduction of value.
Sure.
Right? Stand against the flatland, the deontologizing of value, which means that whatever the price tag says is what the thing is actually worth.
Right. And that's what has become the commonest meaning of value.
Right.
And that's why most people don't think in terms that we're talking about right now. And that's what we're trying to do, is reintroduce this linguistic line of thinking to a commonly understood line.
I mean, it's kind of like, right, Leonard Cohen took the word hallelujah from the Bible into the street. He took the word hallelujah from the Book of Psalms into the public culture.
Right.
In other words, all of a sudden, people have a sense, they have a fragrance of hallelujah.
Yeah.
And he actually got it right. And as he was reading carefully, and hallelujah means, it's a very subtle meaning. It means hallel, pristine praise, how beautiful. And hallelut, drunken, broken intoxication. Mm-hmm. I'm completely broken. And then all of that is, the breath of God. And so Cohen gets that. He takes hallelujah, which had become something else. It had become this formal, you know, word of the cathedrals. And he says, no, there's a holy and broken hallelujah. There's a blaze of light in every word. It doesn't matter which you heard, the holy or the broken hallelujah. And now across the world, there are more covers of hallelujah than any other single album across the world. People don't even exactly know what he's saying, but they can feel hallelujah.
Right.
So it's the same thing that you're saying, Ken, that we want to do with love, with value, which is now when people think value, they think values, and they either think economics or they think fundamentalism. Yep. You know, and it's more a majority values or economics, which is why we're saying, no, there's a field of value. And by the way, although not all Taoist scholars would go this way, but I think if you read really carefully, a good word for the Tao would be the field of value. But the field of value, which is underneath all values. So I want to offer a distinction and then turn, Ken, love to Zach, but just to make this distinction clear, and we've talked about it, Z, which is, let's go back to yesterday, what we were talking about. We were talking about pro-life and pro-choice. So we said life is a value, choice is a value. But both the pro-life people and the pro-choice people who are in this values clash are both outside the field of value. Because, and I want to go slow here for a second, if I'm in the field of value, then we're both first value before we're a specific value. So we're both, before I'm life or before I'm choice, I'm value. And a nice way to think about it would be, the field of value is like the field of true self. So Ken and Mark and Zach, before we're Ken, Mark, and Zach as unique self, we meet each other in the field of true self, which is why we can love each other. Because if we just meet each other as separate selves, well, it's annoying.
right? Why did Ken do integral? Man, I should have written integral. No, not my job. It was his to do. Right? Oh, why am I not like this leading educational theorist? No, that's Zach's to do. That's not mine to do. Right? So we each have something, but if we're separate selves, then our value is our separate self. Then we're in values, then we clash. We have a state of war. Hobbes was right. We step out of values into the field of value into true self. Now we're just in the field of value. Then we can go to unique self. We individuate as Ken and Mark and Zach, and we individuate as individual values, choice, life. Now we can synergize, right? So it's very beautiful. So if I'm talking about values, there's no possibility of synergy because values become identities and they become separate self identities. And we have a polarized value clash in culture. But if we're in the field of value, which is your language now that we talked about yesterday, we created yesterday and talking together and your book coming out, Wholeness. So yesterday we said, oh, let's talk about the field of wholeness. So if I'm in the field of value and the field of wholeness, then when I come to the other side, which is why, for example, if you look at Hindu Brahmin legal scriptures about abortion, they're fascinatingly complex, and they're not in any way pro-life, and not in any way pro-choice. And if you even look at Orthodox Jewish structures of abortion, and when I was in an earlier lifetime, you know, when I was functioning as an Orthodox rabbi, I adjudicated quite a few of those cases of women who were pregnant, and I went to the leading ruler in the Orthodox world was David Feinstein, Moshe Feinstein's son, the ultimate ultra-Orthodox decisor. And he made decisions that would make the pro-life world stand on its head because he was synergizing two values. He was in the field of value and he was synergizing life and choice. But paradoxically, in the last sentence, the liberal world that stepped out of the field of value says there's only one value, choice, and you can never have too much of it. But then the conservative fundamentalist world is also not in the field of value. They say only we are value. There's no field of value. So then they hypothesize life, and you can never have too much of that. So this distinction we're making between values and the field of value, what you're saying, Ken, we need to reclaim like a hallelujah experience. We say the field of value, we all know what we mean beyond polarization, and then we can start the discussion about values. That's exciting. And
let me ask, when we say value among ourselves, do we mean, I mean, when you said there's market value and ecological, natural value. What about personal value? Because I think most people, when they think of value, they definitely think of market value or how much did I pay for that, and they think of ecological value, like how is it doing. But they also think of, if you ask them what's an example of something you value, they often have just their own personal likes and dislikes, and they think of those as values. So when we say value, are we talking, and it's similar to the distinction I made here, are we talking a universal value, or are we talking a personal value, or are we talking a spectrum of values that stretches between those?
So I would say it's a spectrum. So the process of the clarification of desire would begin by kind of releasing you from the idolatry of your specific little value, right? Your specific little personal value, as you're describing, the kind of move away from sacred values towards the kind of like everyday value of the modern, right? It's something Charles Taylor talks about, the kind of making sacred your lifestyle, right? And your lifestyle would be whatever I happen to value, right? And so there's something inside of that, which is the valorization of uniqueness, which is saying, oh, valorization of uniqueness, of personhood. Yeah. That's the core dignity of modernity, is in one sense saying, actually, your lifestyle does matter, right? Actually, so moving into that conversation about personal value, in order to deepen it, and saying, actually, your value for, let's say, your own personhood, right? The integrity of your own personhood. The reason you value that is because the cosmos values.
This is a key distinction we're making
it's
here.
It's a key distinction. The arbitrary kind of relativistic embracing of any lifestyle you happen to like.
That is not value.
That is value in the absence of the clarity about value. It is value in the absence of clarified desire. So it would be pseudo-value. It would be pseudo-erotic pursuit of value. Hopefully you learn in that process and refine and realize, oh, I thought that was valuable. Actually, this is valuable. And so value development proceeds.
Let's lay out a distinction here. This is great. Right? This is a great distinction. So Ken says, right, okay, what about personal value? Right? How does that fit in and relate to, and is that a universal value or is that particular to me, right? Zach points, and I think completely correctly, and I'm going to formulate the distinction differently, but the same, which is we have to make a distinction. Let me go one step back. There's a strange word in modernity, which is it's merely subjective. Right? As if objective was real, that's real. But subjective is always has the word merely before it. But merely is actually not a qualifier of subjective. I mean, actually, reality is, in some sense, from a second-person perspective, infinite subjectivity, right? And we actually, this is actually just in the last 6-7 months, we were trying to think of how would, you know, every generation names God, right? Calling God's name is something that every generation does. And we were thinking about how do we call God's name, you know, in the language of cosmoerotic humanism. And what emerged was is this beautiful word, God as the infinite intimate. God as the infinite intimate. So that's God is ultimate objectivity and ultimate subjectivity with no split between them. Now, if that's true, part of the human experience of subjectivity is one of the first principles and first values of cosmos, which is not irreducible uniqueness. As the old conversation we used to have with our friend Andrew, not just social conditioning, not just psychological conditioning, not just cultural conditioning, there's an irreducible kenness that's more than the story of his father. Right? It's an imprint into the world which reality intended and desired. And even the Buddhists affirm that. They just slip it in the back door through reincarnation, right? What's right? So that irreducible uniqueness means that's personhood. So personhood, not personhood as broken, separate self, seeking, mind, personality, you know, contraction, coiled contraction, you know, what, you know, the opposite of the bright, you know, not all of that, right? But no, the infinite dignity of my irreducible personhood, right? That actually is irreducibly unique. And that begins, it's only when I value that, I get to understand the great sin of what we're calling techno-feudalism. Because the techno-feudalist enterprise seeks to essentially harvest your data through the asymmetric power of machine intelligence. And then without your knowing, beyond the pale of your awareness, through invisible technologies of control, reduce you to your lowest common denominator. And when you read Pentland at the MIT Media Lab, he says, we're not interested in uniqueness. We're not interested in anomalies. They're statistically irrelevant. Right. That's actually what he calls them. And so therefore, there's no dignity of personhood. So there's no reason not to steal your attention, which is a function of your personhood, or your data, because there's no personhood. So personhood is personal value. There's a personal value, I think that's what you were pointing towards. There's a personal value which is expressed in your irreducible uniqueness, which then participates in a unique self-symphony.
Yeah.
That's the key
unique
sentence.
Unique self is what informs your personal isness
yes.
and value.
But it has to be part of a unique self-symphony And Zach, you cited Kant when we were talking about that, about the kind of, or Rawls, about the kingdom of ends, where, right, so maybe you want to talk to that, but that's related.
Well, I was going to go in a different direction, which is that when you begin the conversation about techno-feudalism, when you begin the conversation about the colonization of our life world by these invasive technologies, what's interesting is that the way in, the way they get you, the way they first open that door, and where you
get, you're hearing good,
where you let them walk in, basically, was with the making of the self sacred. Like, what did Facebook do? What did MySpace do? The first things, what does Instagram do? It's the idolatry of the self. That's the door that they walk through that lets you get them all your data, all the back end, all the surveillance, all the behavior manipulation. So they walk through that same door of, okay, there's nothing sacred. The baseline value is your own self-promotion.
So we hijack that.
So through the search for self-expression, through the search for connection, through the search for being seen as unique, through the search for being seen as valuable, that's where they find a way to turn your behavior against your own sincere pursuit of value. They distort value very profoundly, which is why this category of anti-value, or this category of basically pseudo-eros, or the pseudo-value, is so important, because most of what people pursue is not the result of clarified desire. It is the result of the manipulation of desire. And we're at the level where the manipulation of desire now goes from kind of persuasion, which would be what advertising was, where you're trying to talk someone into it, where now I believe we have coercive information technologies, which means you can't not be affected in these ways, whereas you can kind of ignore the advertisements. We're at the point now where the technologies...
An immersive environment.
Exactly. And it's intentional. I mean, the Pentland lab at the MIT Media Lab, but you also get the Stanford lab, basically, which I forget the exact name of it.
B.F. Fogg's Persuasive Technique Laboratory.
Yeah, so
right.
Persuasive technologies. And I believe that beyond a certain point, persuasion becomes coercion, basically. And so we're in a situation now where we're being more or less coerced into holding values that we don't actually have, that we would not have.
By people who have declared that there's no field of value.
That's why they can do it without any...
That's right. In other words, and it's B.F. Fogg's at the Persuasive Technology Lab explicitly bases his work on Skinner, on B.F. Skinner. And in Beyond Freedom and Dignity, the chapter before the last chapter is a chapter on value. And he engages in... the chapter is almost impossible to read by intention. It's the ultimate set of euphemisms. And then on page 200 and 201, he drops the facade, and he basically says, you know, we need to move beyond, you know, what C.S. Lewis was talking about. And he mentions Lewis, and you get he's angry at Lewis because Lewis wrote that book, The Abolition of Man, in 1943, where he's basically attacking Skinner, where he's describing how a few good men will come to be the controllers who will control everything through these irresistible, he calls it, Lewis, irresistible scientific methods. Skinner's burned by it. It's now 1971, right? And he writes this thing, and Lewis was wrong. He says, he doesn't use these words, but he describes existential risk, and he says, autonomous man who's invested with ethics, right, man who can choose, that man who's invested with freedom and dignity, because he has intrinsic value, said we have to move beyond that man. We have to move to the man who's only real in that which is, the exact quote is, observable and manipulable. It's a direct quote. Observable and manipulable. And then Skinner, those two pages are the structure that essentially... the entire tech, and Skinner says, I don't know how to do it yet, though, because I don't have the instruments and methods.
And I've just spent the last 200 pages trying to do it.
Right, right, totally trying to do it. And then we thought we killed stuff. Chomsky thought, right, Chomsky and Kessler, right, there's a series of these reviews that go to kill Skinner. Looks like Skinner was dead, but he was actually faking it. Right. What he was doing was... in the book by Brian Deere, Friendly Orange Glow, Zach?
Yeah.
Friendly Orange Glow. We found that book by accident. It's this brilliant independent scholar who writes about the early Plato system of the internet before kind of the internet, the proto-internet, and his entire first chapter is on B.F. Skinner, who has this realization that actually these are going to become the instruments and methods. He dies, Skinner, and then along comes the first wave of AI, data science, machine intelligence, and essentially Alex Pentland, who's the founder of the MIT Media Lab, directly devours Skinner, pretends like he never read him, like Locke pretended like he never read Hobbes.
Right.
And then when you read Pentland, and his public book was called Social Physics, 2014, he basically literally resurrects Skinner and basically says there's no free will. Free will is not real. He says value is not real. But none of this does he say explicitly. You could read the whole Social Physics book and not catch it. So it got like 20 great reviews in the liberal community. But when you read it really slowly, Zach and I read it really slowly, carefully, and we read it and compared it to Skinner. Then we looked at older papers of Pentland, and you realize he's directly, by intention, reprising Skinner. And his assumption is freedom's not real, value's not real, uniqueness is statistically irrelevant, love is not real, eros is not real. And Pentland is not the MIT Media Lab. These are not side players. These are the mainstream legacy architects of the whole story. And it's all based on one thing. There's no hallelujah. Because what hallelujah says is that it doesn't matter which you heard.
Wait, did he actually say there's no hallelujah?
No, no. I'm saying what hallelujah means is that it just occurs to me now to say it this way. But hallelujah means value.
Means
value.
Yeah.
That's really what hallelujah. Hallelujah means when David says hallelujah, he says, fuck, I'm agonized, I'm devastated, I've been rejected, I've been trampled, but I'm in the field of wholeness, I'm in the field of value. So I'm going to scream. But hallelujah means, that's what I mean, there's a blaze of light in every word, it doesn't matter which you heard, the holy or broken hallelujah. What he means is it's all in the field of hallelujah, it's all in the field of value. So no matter what happens, I've never left the field of value. Because you can't leave the field of value because you're always in the Tao. So as you said, Ken, restoring the language of the field of value beyond A, as you said, economic value and the distinctions of value that you cited 25 minutes ago, all of them that went economic instrumental, Zach, beyond, you know, kind of the surface versions of ecological value that what's his name pointed to so beautifully. What is his name? Ralston, Homer Ralston. Right. Wrote beautifully, ecologically, you know, kind of about, right. Was it Homer? Right. It was the person that, yeah, doesn't matter. Yeah. But yeah, enough. That's the field of value.
Yeah. Well, right. When you say that, you know, this guy says there's no value, there's no love, there's no et cetera.
No freedom.
No, I mean, it's all pathetic. And one of the reasons that I, in the language that I chose to use for fundamental constituents mm-hmm. of the universe, they had to apply fairly well to all four quadrants. Because most hard-headed, like empiricists, take just the external, exterior, right-hand quadrants as real. So is an ecosystem real? Yeah, that's real. Is a brain real? Yeah, that's real. Is an atom real? Yeah, that's real. So I use the term holon, because even quarks are holons, and nobody, right. No standard model physicist would right. disagree with that.
Right.
And then when I had to come to term for consciousness, because it's hard for a lot of people, even me sometimes, to think of a proton as having consciousness. Certainly doesn't have an elaborate self-consciousness. But I ran upon Whitehead's term, prehension.
Right.
Which is great, because almost nobody knows what prehension means. It's just Dutch.
Opens up the field there.
Yeah, right. It does. It makes it a lot easier to,
right.
to yeah, push totally. That on somebody when they don't know what you're pushing on them. And so and so I have a spectrum of prehension.
Right.
And then when I get up to concrete operational or formal operational, I can start introducing terms like awareness or consciousness, concrete operational thinking. That's one of the things that we're going to have to do here. Because we're talking now fairly easily about consciousness and value and even love as eros.
Right.
We're talking all the way down.
Right.
And so let's just keep in mind whatever terms we use. Let's really think of them in a four quadrant way.
Yes. Yes.
Because it's going to be really important in terms of getting value to be an explicit part of every citizen's internal state.
Right. Which is the goal. I mean, I think the formulation of that's the goal.
Yeah.
It's very, very important to formulate it. Zach.
Well, if you think about everyone agrees there's a climate crisis, let's put something like that.
Yeah.
So the idea that there's an objective state of affairs with the climate, we agree. The idea that we're in a crisis of value, people would be like, I don't know, are we in a crisis of value? Like the people who would say something that would be fundamentalist or something, right? But it should be as clear as day, as clear as a superstorm, or as clear as a melting glacier, or something like that, that you cannot run a civilization on value relativism.
You
cannot run a civilization on relativism.
Right.
You cannot run a civilization on nihilism.
Right.
You cannot run a civilization on
empiricism.
Precisely, because those are all related. And so that should be as clear as like, oh, you can't keep extracting endlessly from the environment.
Right.
And yet, because of the state of the culture, there's deep confusion about even the idea that the fundamental problem is a problem of value, when in fact
the fundamental
is a problem of value.
Yes.
It's very fundamentally.
Yeah.
Again, I think sex, ecology, spirituality, just because we're here, and I think about, then you were saying that it's not the CO2 that's the problem. It's not the emissions. It's our minds that's the problem, which is another way of saying it's, how are we valuing this? It's a crisis of value. And decision-making and level of consciousness before any of the environmental things come in. And yet it's so easy these days to talk about the environmental stuff.
Yeah.
And so difficult to get out of the relativism, to get out of the nihilism. Yeah.
That reminds me, actually, when you said that not many people think that there's a value crisis. But what almost everybody talks about now is a meaning crisis.
Right.
And everybody knows what you mean when you say we've got a meaning, a loss of meaning. Right. Our meaning crisis. So what does meaning mean?
Is this a pause? I don't want to interrupt.
Yeah.
Is that okay? So it's such a great distinction. It's got me very excited, the distinction, right? Because we talked earlier, and we were talking yesterday, about critics of the techplex saying, how could the techplex hijack attention? Because after all, Shoshana Zuboff, for example, you can't find your inward space of meaning, she says. You can't find your inward space of meaning. But then she refuses to identify meaning with anything which is real in a field of value. So she then cites Sartre, right, the apostle of cosmic meaninglessness, as her source for meaning, which is a very bad move, right? That's a very, very, you know, Walter Kaufman called that back in the day intellectual gerrymandering.
Oh.
It's a great term, right? It's an intellectual gerrymandering move. She's hijacking the language, but actually what she's actually signaling is that she wants to be kosher with Pinker, who's down the hall in Harvard, right? And she wants to be a good postmodernist, that there is no real field of value. So one of the ways that this crisis of meaning is used today is to actually avoid the value conversation, right? In other words, there's a crisis of meaning.
Absolutely.
Right? And it's a very clever move, right? There's a certain intellectual move that's being made. Let's avoid the value thing. Let's talk about a crisis of meaning. That's very appropriate. And that can be answered without asserting value. And in some sense, the entire fucking existentialist movement was to engage the crisis of meaning by avoiding the field of value.
Okay, so what
this
you,
is exciting.
What you point, yes, and what you pointed to is another central concern of what we have to be doing, which is interlinking and resurrecting value to go with meaning.
Yes, yes, that's right. You're right.
So when we're talking about value, because almost everything that has value has meaning.
Right.
And so, and most things that have meaning have value.
Right.
And so we can resurrect a meaning and a cure for the meaning crisis while we're resurrecting
yes.
a value.
And that would be the only Please. Cure. The only cure to the meaning crisis is to clarify value.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's, and this is actually going back to the question of why. The question right. of why is about meaning,
right.
and we're saying, no, there's a bad way to answer the question why, which would be the existentialist answer to the meaning crisis, which is whatever the why ever the fuck you want. That's why.
Yeah.
Whatever you want. And we're saying, on the other side of passing through the clarification of value, you ask again why, right? And
yeah.
now meaning is self-evident, right?
Right.
The real contact with value clarifies meaning, right? So the clarification of desire reveals value. Contact with value provides meaning. So what we're trying to get out of is the semantic answer
yeah.
to the why question.
Right.
The why question cannot be answered semantically. It can only be answered by merging with the field of value, engaging value, having meaning redeemed
yes.
in your life. Something like that.
Yes. Absolutely. And let's clarify. We all understand, I mean, we shouldn't even have to clarify this, but maybe if someone's joining us for a first dialogue, we all understand that there are social constructions that are real. We all understand that all meaning and all value is mediated through historical prisms. We all understand that truth is not just a mirror of an objective reality, right? We all understand that value is not just eternal value. That's the point of our book, First Principles and First Values, that value is evolving value. So let's take that as a given, so no one should misunderstand this as a kind of disguised fundamentalist trope, quite the opposite.
Right.
We're taking as an axiom that we're talking about value, which is both real, intrinsic, and evolving, right, at the kind of very core of the universe, and that meaning, and that's it's so beautiful to say, meaning is... Zach, as you were saying, Ken, as you pointed to in the question, meaning is rooted in the field of value, right?
Right.
That's its essential nature.
And meaning is very intrinsic to the human condition. So when the simplest meaning of the word meaning is any signifier has meaning. Any word, any symbol we use is a signifier because it points to something
right.
other. The signified.
Right.
So signifier and signified. That's meaning. So we're generating meaning with every word we make now.
Yes.
And
yes.
we just have to hook that to value.
And we just have to hook that to value. And let's even, and now let's go down the evolutionary chain back to what you said earlier, right? So we were having a conversation with all of our mutual colleague and friend, Howard Bloom, who kind of sets himself up, although we don't believe him, but he
yeah.
sets himself up in public as he calls himself a stone cold atheist.
Right.
You know, he's an atheist like I'm the Pope. But in other words, he definitely does reject all of the medieval and modern caricatures of religion. And so, you know, Howard and I began, Zach joined us, and it's in an early draft, right, just to think about these ideas. And I think it needs to become part of anthropology, this notion that meaning, from a scientific perspective, goes all the way down, right? And so, for example, when you have a proton and a neutron and electron that are coming together to create a new whole called an atom.
A holon.
Right, which is a holon. So that is, and it's beautiful, that is, number one, it's a new intimacy. So there's an eros and an allurement. There's a new intimacy. So what happens?
Well, holons are just degrees in increasing intimacy.
Holon, the assumption, the declaration of holons is that evolution is the progressive deepening of intimacies.
Right.
Right. I mean, that would be, that's what holons are screaming
right.
at. So now it gets very exciting because, So we've got this proton, neutron, and electron, A. Two is they're allured to each other. Three, they form a shared identity, which is a new wholeness. But that shared identity is in the context of a mutuality of recognition. They obviously recognize each other. They feel each other, so they have shared pathos. But they also have
shared value.
Right? They have shared purpose.
And prehension.
And prehension, right? Prehension and shared value. And by shared value is in the sense that if they didn't have shared value, meaning if they weren't communicating in some way, right?
They would have no reason to integrate.
And they couldn't integrate. There's actually codes of communication, right? It's a conversation of kind. And in that sense, you could say it's a conversational cosmos all the way down. And conversation is the exchange of meaning,
right,
which is embedded in value. So there's actually, in a very real way, and this is actually, I think, much more accessible, right, to the broader public culture than thinking about when you say a proton is conscious, people get lost. When you actually begin to realize that in order for an atom to be formed by a proton, neutron, and electron, there needs to be shared scripts of value because there's a conversation that has meaning. No, that's actually true. That's not a conjecture.
Right.
And when our friend Howard Bloom, you know, thinks about this, he says, "Wow, I'm a complete scientist," right? And sometimes in a more honest day, he calls himself a materialist mystic.
Yeah.
Right. Which is closer. But the point is, he's a pure kind of materialist scientist in the sense that he refuses to introduce any quote unquote what he would call supernatural causes that are not intrinsic.
Like communication.
That's right, right, right. And there you have communication, right? Yep. Exactly. And he says you can't, he agrees with us that you cannot talk about an atom without there being codes of meaning, right, that actually create the allurement that creates the wholeness.
It's communication.
Communication, right? And so that's beautiful. So wholeness always implies conversation, which always implies meaning.
And value.
Which always implies value. Holy fuck, right?
Right.
Beautiful.
And
yeah.
Beautiful.
And conversation's interesting because it blurs the lines between instrumental and intrinsic value.
Yep.
It's like, okay, a good conversation exists for its own sake, no doubt.
And we have to blur that distinction. Correct. If we're going to carry it all the way down into quarks.
Precisely. And so there has to be some mode of activity which is both in and of itself valuable and extrinsically,
right,
instrumentally valuable for other purposes.
Right.
So conversations like this one is,
right,
both of those. It's like the Shema, right?
For its own sake.
So we've managed to hook it down,
yeah,
into the most fundamental,
right,
of a quadrant.
Which is
in the most scientific way, in the most,
yeah,
precisely scientific way. No animism.
Yeah. And if I dare say, like the notion of Leela, right? Or is it Lila or play, right? That most basic notion of conversation as both serious and not serious,
right,
as both intrinsic and somehow accomplishing something. That's very interesting. What's the most basic thing that's happening? Some type of serious yet playful conversation in pursuit of what? Some open-ended expression of value, open-ended pursuit of value. Anyway, that's like a bad answer to the why question.
But it also solves another problem, which is if you want to try and understand what's the relationship between kind of contingency, randomness, and design, that big question.
Right.
So all you have to do is look at this conversation, and actually all of our conversations through the years. We've never once prepared for a conversation. We've never prepared a script. We've never prepared an outline. Right? We've always come together. There's always been the sense of play, the sense of Leela, Zach invokes, the sense of delight. And yet, if you would then read the transcript of the conversation, you would think that we had spent literally weeks orchestrating, oh, Ken will say that, and then Mark, right? And then right, now we're talking with Zach, and then Zach, right? And so it's complete. When you look at it post facto, it looks completely designed, and yet it's completely filled with contingency, surprise, and not randomness, but freedom, openness. So you actually see in this conversation the actual structure of evolution itself at play, as conversations all the way up and conversations all the way down. Now that is crazy exciting, and that gets to be the interior of what's now exteriorized as information theory.
Right.
And information theory is the attempt to take conversation, take the music out of the conversation, and yep. reduce it to its mechanics.
Right.
Wow. It's exciting. Right? It's exciting to be back together.
Which is the main problem with it, too.
Which is the main problem with it.
I mean, it's essentially turning the exchange of meaning into like a causal process, just causality, right?
Yeah.
But meaning is beyond the category of causality.
Right.
And that's what's so interesting about the first principles, first values notion, that it's attempting to blur is and ought, and it's attempting to blur the causal and the normative, right? Which is to say, why does something occur in the world? Is it because of causality, or is it because there's agency?
Yeah.
Right? And Whitehead was also exploring categories that had both qualities.
Right. Right?
That for him, causality doesn't exist, but prehension exists. But what is prehension at a very low level looks a lot just like causality, right?
Yeah.
And so similarly, we're talking about how values express themselves through the material and the biological, through this conversational process, which if you're just a physicist, you would read as, oh, that's just causality. But then what the fuck are we? If you read that as conversation, then we make sense.
Right.
Then we're just having a conversation.
That's right.
It's been going on for billions of years. As opposed to, no, there was no meaning exchange, there was no teleology.
And our conversations have lost meaning.
Right.
And therefore we have a meaning crisis.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's the core of it. In other words,
Goes down to the atom.
That goes down to the atom, right? The core of it is. Right, that's gorgeous, right? In other words, all through reality, conversations have had meaning. It's right from the beginning of time. And all of this, and all of those conversations are coded in us. Because although not all of evolution is in me, but all of the stages of evolution are most of the stages. So I have atoms in me, and I have leptons, hadrons, muons, and I have, right, you know, single cell, multi-cell. I've got everything's in me. So all of those conversations are happening, which means I'm constituted by meaningful conversations. My interiors are physically constituted by meaningful interior conversations.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, I then try and have a conversation with someone else, right? And I'm desperate to have that conversation, right? I'm remember that movie, Tom Hanks, Castaway. He's on an island, right? He's warden.
Wilson.
Right. And see, the Wilson basketball. He paints his blood, a face on a Wilson basketball because he's desperate to have a conversation, even though he's worked out all the neo-Darwinian survival issues.
Right.
But he's desperate to have a conversation, and he's so desperate for his interior to have a meaningful conversation with another interior that he's willing to throw himself off the island into the ocean with almost no chance of survival on the slim chance that he might be able to once again, before he dies, have a conversation. And there was no one in the world who didn't get the movie. Right. No one was like, huh, that's really weird. Why is he doing that? Everyone got like, of course. So you get this kind of public culture recognition, and all of a sudden we understand the root of mental crises. So now all of a sudden I'm told that there are no meaningful conversations that exist, right? Because there's no shared value, there's no love story, right? And I'll just give one example of this, which is a frightening and stunning example, is the movie that won they created a special Golden Globe Award, right, for best performance at the box office this year, was Barbie.
Yeah.
Barbie.
And they had to create that in order to be able to give Barbie
some sort of award. Right. They wanted to write, and Barbie actually went wild to the box office.
Yeah.
And Barbie's about this story in which Ken wants to be a hero.
Right.
But there are no heroes.
Right,
because a hero is so beautiful. A hero has valor. Valor is valiant. Valiant participates in value. They're all the same Latin root, which goes back to valeria or valentia, which means be strong and value, which is rooted in, very beautiful, valentius, Valentine, love.
So you've got this stunning Latin root, which is the hero participates in the field of value. Therefore, the hero is willing to give him or herself up for the sake of the field, because the hero experiences there's a larger field of value beyond my separate self. So we get to Barbie, and what Barbie basically says is, there's no field of value. That's the point of the movie. There's a moment where Barbie wants to become human, and Mrs. Mattel, right, Ruth, tells her, you know, humans just make meaning up. There is no real meaning. He says, well, that's okay. I'll do it anyways. And Ken can't be a hero because there's no heroes,
right?
Because there's no value. And the whole point of the movie is not that this Barbie doesn't love this Ken. It's that there is no Barbie in Ken. There is no love story. And so you walk out of the movie. I remember the phenomenological feeling. I had the same feeling walking out of Barbie that I had finishing reading our friend Yuval Harari's Homo Sapiens. This chilled feeling. You're like, something's wrong. And you're not sure why, because you just got told there's no field of value, but in a very eloquent way. And so then Barbie gets this, they have to create an award. At the Oscars, the great moment was, three weeks ago, was when Ryan Gosling sings I'm Just Ken. He brings the house down.
Right.
But if you read the words of I'm Just Ken, it's the pathos of, but I've got to be more than just a life of blonde fragility.
Right.
And my desire's got to mean something. But of course, they place that in the mouth of Ken, who's patriarchy. So it's this, and of course, Harari does the same thing. There's no field of value, and you're chilled. You can't be a hero. So we're saying to people, you actually can be a hero. And you're a hero in every conversation. I mean, this is...
Yeah.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, that's great. Listening to you reminded me of another aspect that I think we should talk about, whether we need to work it in or not. And that has to do with Eros. And in particular, well, I'll preface this by saying, we're tracing this all the way down to quarks and atoms, and then all the way up through molecules, cells, multicellular animals, the entire tree of life, linguistic communication, what our talk, and so on. And that points out that Eros is a creative drug. Yes. And yes. Creativity has to be hooked in here somehow. Yes. With meaning and value.
Yes.
And yes. I'm not sure exactly how, but whatever we think will be the way to tie them together, we can reinforce that by saying our creative value. That's or great. Our creative meaning.
That's great. Great. Zach, you want to take a crack at that first?
Yeah, there's a few things to say. One is that...
That's a really important...
That's perfect, right? So if we think about, again, to just bring Whitehead back, right? So the creative advance into novelty is one way of thinking about evolution.
Yeah.
And the idea that you can make choices that direct evolution in ways that are not good.
Right.
So therefore, value is something that is a rudder. It's a steering mechanism. It's a...
Is
a rudder or steering wheel or North Star for directing creativity, right? Because if you think about our civilization, in one sense, it's massively creative.
Like
to do a fracking organization, the tar sands up in Alberta, the size of the UK, that's a massive, huge creation, which is completely antithetical to value. So creation itself isn't necessarily good. Creation that serves, pursues, moves us towards true value is good. So I would see this relation between creativity and value as that. There's a constraining of the total possibility of creation by the pursuit of value. And getting off of the ability to know what's valuable allows us to create anything and see it as valuable.
Well, this undercuts another factor that we're working into all of our conversations, and that is different terms we're using, positive and negative. Right. And everything we're talking about has a good and a bad version.
Right.
Value, there's good, there's bad. Wholeness, there's good, there's bad. A bad example of wholeness is the collapse of the Roman Empire.
Right.
That was a very systematic whole,
right.
And it sucked.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It really
right.
did. It was just all sorts of shit came from that.
It's great.
There's good creative and there's bad creative.
Let's pick up, right, that thread, Ken, and that thread, Zach. Let's pick up both threads. So first creativity, one creativity, Zach's comments, right? Then let's call it, I mean, the words that we've been playing with, right, are value and anti-value.
Yeah.
Wholeness and anti-wholeness.
Yeah.
In which anti-value almost has its own ontology.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just Aristotelian privation.
Right.
Right. But there's actually a sense of ontology, and that was very, very strong in the lineage of Solomon. It was the sense that there's not that evil is a full ontology. It's not a Gnostic, right? It's not a Gnostic position. It's not about a demiurgus. It's not about committing suicide to get out of this world. But there's a sense of this, and we can actually feel it in the world. Right, it's the sense of Sauron.
Of
Sauron, the eye of Sauron
right.
in Lord of the Rings. There's a Sauron is not just the privation of the good. Sauron is this ontological or almost ontological force.
Bad.
Right, that's bad. And the text in the Book of Psalms that's cited in the lineage is always Zel Umatzeh Bara Elohim. This corresponding to this did reality manifest. So the reality manifests value and anti-value, which is eros and thanatos, but it's really a better way to say it is actually eros and anti-eros. It's actually more clear. And when you think about this sense of anti-wholeness, the Holy Roman Empire, or which was at least Roman, well, it wasn't even that Roman, but I guess it was an empire, but it absolutely, that's a great example of this ring of Sauron, right? Which is about this enveloping wholeness, right? It's this wild, quote unquote, creative force in which nothing can be outside of the eye of Sauron. It's not the eye of value, it's the eye of anti-value, and it wants to absorb and gobble up everything in which nothing can be left out because that would be a lack of wholeness. And nothing's left out of the Roman Empire. I mean, so the sense of anti-value is very important. And but now let's link it to creativity. So it's interesting, public culture always intuitively understands something, even when it gets it wrong, which is why you can speak to public culture, because it actually has this very beautiful grounding, even when it's unconscious, in the Tao, in the field of value. So educationally, in the world of education, right, Zach, your world, there was this moment for 30, 40, 50 years that's still out there, it's slightly less pronounced, in which you're trying, the educational value was your child be creative. It's a major thing in schools, right, all over the place, right? Want to make sure your child's going to really learn to be creative. So there was this sense that, oh, schools are not allowed to teach value. But they'll teach skills, and we'll teach your child to be creative. But there was this recognition that creativity was a value. But what happened is just like pro-choice and pro-life, creativity itself was decontextualized from the field of value, turned into the absolute value. And so then creativity meant moving commodities, it meant junk bonds, it meant Sam Bankman-Fried on a bad day. Right, in crypto, it meant this sense of you're wildly creative, and in a certain sense, that was the true value. If you couldn't, that was success, that was the true value. If you couldn't achieve that, then we've often said between us, the booby prize was you were sincere. Like you're very devotional, right? Right there. He's very sincere.
Right.
He's very devoted. Right, right, right. He's right. Or the worst is sincerity, devotion, and purity. He's a very pure soul.
Right.
Right, right. In other words, and it's complete failure. He's not succeeded in this commodified, you know, measurement of wild creativity, but he's very sincere. So we have to actually recontextualize the creative in the field of value. And I remember, you know, this very beautiful statement by a teacher of mine that I only spoke to once. And I used to sit outside his apartment in the Washington Heights. And his name was Joseph Soloveitchik. And he was too old for me to attend his formal Talmud lectures, but when I was 13, 14, I would go to anything I could hear. I read all of his books, and I sat outside his door to get a glimpse of him and talk to him for a second, which was the sense of devotion. And of course, I was so excited and so idiotic that I thought I was the only person who really understood his works. So I wanted to tell him that I understood it so he'd be less lonely. I was committed to this. It's a committed 15-year-old project. And I finally found him, and I kind of pushed him way through his attendance, and I told him this, and he looked at me, but he kind of got it, and said, thank you. So he writes in an essay called The Man of Law, right? It's a very beautiful essay, and he writes that there's a very beautiful section on the sacred, and he says the sacred is self-creation. Self-creation is the sacred. Right, and that the self is the tapestry of creation. And it's interesting, he had just gotten disillusioned with Heidegger. He had gone to Heidegger's lectures in 1931, you know, and Husserl, and that's the world he wrote his doctorate there. Soloveitchik, he was the greatest Talmudist of the era, but he wrote his doctorate on neo-Kantianism, and he went to Heidegger's lectures. Then he got completely devastated when Heidegger kind of makes his Nazi move for at least a couple of years. You know, Michael Zimmerman kind of writes about that well, actually. Right. You know, and I've just been reading his book for the first time, and it's actually a great book. And, you know, Heidegger has this great statement where he says, you know, the human being is the only being who problematizes their own being.
Yeah.
It's very beautiful, actually. And that's what Soloveitchik was emerging, saying, no, actually, self-creation, right, is the sacred. And that's very beautiful. Now we've recontextualized creativity in the field of self, which is the field of value. Now we have a conversation.
Right. And I'll say one thing, and then maybe we move to close. But so I can't think about this conversation without thinking about this category of the emerge. So you have this conversation, right? The eye of value, which allows us to see intrinsic value, which can bind desire, can hold the will, and allow creativity to be flowing with the cosmos, right? And then you have the eye of anti-value, which actively seeks out the sacred to destroy it, which would mean, in the conversational context, it would be destroying conversations, and it would be seeking to destroy the deepest conversations you could have. So it would be using Barbie to make it impossible for you in your relationship to talk about love, actually.
Right.
That's the most... The eye of anti-value is advertising. It is the thing that gets right into your heart and clicks the thing, and now you can't see correctly what you value. So there's, of course, the term Messiah means...
Conversation.
To raise the conversation, right?
Right.
So very much what we're attempting to do, what this re-articulation of a new language for value would allow for would be... throughout all of these conversations, a changing of the conversation, which would say, actually, Barbie's insane.
Right.
It's actually insane. We need, where it's not even like you have to argue against it anymore, and this is the way Habermas talks about cultural evolution. It's like, no, the old ways of making arguments don't even work anymore. We're in a new stratum of language and justification. And so similarly, we need to move out of the place where you can have as an assumption that there's no field of value, back into a place where you have as an assumption that there's a field of value. Like, I think it was
right.
in the Religion of Tomorrow, Ken, where you say something like, in medieval times, God was everywhere. And then you get modernity and God's nowhere. And then what's ever next, God is everywhere again. And that's a very fundamental messianic...
That's the field of value.
And the messianic transformation of the assumption behind all the conversations that are occurring.
Right. And that involves a pre-trans.
Yes.
Pre-trans.
What I'm getting is, as I'm listening to us talk, is that, let's say the result of our conversations on value come out as a book.
Right.
What would that book be called? And an idea that keeps coming back to me is, because we talked about value, and that led us to meaning,
right,
and wholeness and creativity.
Right.
So listen to all those different terms that we're mm-hmm. introducing, and in a sense recontextualizing and giving new meaning to.
Right.
So what if we had like a book called, it wouldn't be this, it would be something clever, The Meaning Crisis, or The Crisis of Meaning in Today's World, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we start with meaning and introduce value and then development and evolution and then creativity and eros and et cetera. So, because I'm sure we're going to come up with several other topics that
that's a good start.
Drawing. Yeah. And so if we just play that out, it would be, here's meaning, here's the meaning of meaning.
Right.
And here's value, and here's creativity, and pre-trans, God, and so on. Anyway, that's just, I just tossed that out.
No, it's great. It's great. It's beautiful. Right? I mean, that's great. I mean, maybe, and I know we're wrapping, and it's, first off, it's just, it's delightful to be back in conversation. We didn't take that much time off, maybe like 10 months or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's great. It's great to pick up, and congratulations on our first book out together, David J. Temple. It's very sweet of him. And as we move into this kind of anthrontology and value, kind of the next step, right? You know, I want to just play off of what you said, Ken, and what you said, Zach, and we invoked this Hebrew trope that Messiah, Mashiach, means siach, conversation. And if, by the way, if anyone wants to source it, it's in a man named Nachum of Chernobyl, right, who wrote a book called The Light of the Eyes, and it's in the section on Pinchas, and our dear colleague Arthur Green translated it, and he did a very good job. So anyone can also find the translation of it, that Mashiach, siach, means conversation. So in essence, what Messianism, Messiah is, in some sense, waking up and growing up and, right, showing up and cleaning up and opening up your language. Right? Messiah is the new human, new humanity. Messiah is homo amor, language we've used. So Messiah's the one who reinvigorates conversation at the human level as intrinsically meaningful. And I would just want to go back to that earlier image that just kind of emerged from between us, which is understanding that the mental breakdown, which is the source of the metacrisis, the core breakdown of self.
The meaning crisis.
The meaning crisis, if you will, right, is sourced in this human being who experiences their whole physicality and their interiors being all these meaningful conversations, and then you're told that there's not an ultimately meaningful conversation to be had.
Right.
And then all of your conversations feel like the hollow men and the stuffed men. Right?
The eye of Sauron is everywhere.
The eye of Sauron is everywhere.
And it started by getting rid of value.
And it started by getting rid of value.
Because value and meaning are hooked, it very quickly became a meaning crisis. And it hasn't quite destroyed the meaning of meaning for people, because everybody talks about the meaning crisis. Therefore, they know what they're missing.
Right. There's a sense it's missing.
But when Eye of Sauron finishes with meaning, there won't even be a meaning crisis. There'll just be a nothingness.
Well, that's what AI would do.
Think
about what AI is, right? It's producing text on a screen, which you perceive as meaningful, which actually is not meaningful. It's not produced.
It's pretending, and this is the point that you've made, Zach, before, right? So Zach's made the point before is that, you know, if AI would actually look like it was AI, it would be okay. But it's pretending to personify itself. So another way to say that is the same thing, your core point, but let me move it into
this Messiah conversation. It's pretending to have a conversation.
Yeah,
it's so it's hijacking the very notion of conversation, which is the which is the debasing.
And it will also make it so that anytime I read text on a screen, I'm thinking, was this text produced by a human, or was this text produced by something that isn't human, that has no intended communicative intent, it has no semantic manipulation ability. So it's this deep thing where it's moving past the meaning crisis and possibly taking away our ability to create meaning, even in the very simple sense of like having language that we share together.
I mean, here's the strange analogy. The same way that the pornographic universe actually literally deconstructs people's ability to participate in eros, including sexually, because the pornographic universe deadens. So in the same way, right, this AI-invested world of artificial conversations literally is it's a kind of pornographic universe that de-eroticizes your capacity to have a conversation. And maybe this is, as a close, it's not by accident that we're responding to this by having conversations, right? In other words, we're saying we're going to actually have conversations that are ultimately meaningful, and we're going to share those conversations.
Yeah, and until the field of value is understood such that conversation matters again,
right?
Then you won't care if you're talking to an AI. So it's like until the humans clarify what they are and what it's worth to be a human, right now it's very difficult to convince.
And that's another fundamental area that we'll be talking about, which is communication and conversation.
Huge.
And that we've already established those go all the way down.
Goes all the way down. Right?
So,
and what is the definition of polarization? Which is one of the major vectors of the meta-crisis, is the incapacity to have a conversation. Right? And once there's a conversation that's happening, then we can play.
And I would say the universe starts again.
And even in our, I'm not going to invoke any particular piece of anyone's autobiography or biography, but I'd say we're all familiar in the very real world of the places where the tragedy was not that the conversation broke apart. The tragedy was the conversation never started. It never happened.
And our conversation happens to follow all the principles we're talking about.
Right.
It's a drive from one hole on to a greater hole on. And that's what we're trying, that's what we're groping for. We're evolving.
We're evolving.
As we're talking about
it. And you can feel the joy in it.
You can feel the joy in it.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. That was awesome.